Microbiology and the newly opened Louis Stigler Institute for Integrative Genomics, part of an interdisciplinary group of physicists, computer scientists, biologists, chemical engineers who are thinking about issues in biology that would benefit from interdisciplinary interactions. My background is mixed. I did go to medical school for a couple of years and did an MD-PhD program, but my PhD was in biophysics. It was mostly biology then physics. I got interested in looking at protein-DNA interactions and transcriptional networks very early on during my graduate career, long before people thought that it was even possible to make the sort of measurements that we're now routinely making. So it's been a lot of fun. So the title of my talk is From DNA Sequence to Gene Expression, and it's supposed to arouse a more of a wish about what we want to do in this field, which is to be able to predict, much as we do in the case of functioning, of the function of protein sequences that we find from genomes, something about their expression, something about their regulation from sequence alone. That's the general idea that I'd like to motivate. So this is a very simplified model of a cell, extremely simplified, but it's amazing how far this kind of simplification gets you in actually doing something in biology. So this is a cell, you know, this is the external world, this is the internal world, and much of what cells do is about transferring information. So the particular implementation of the molecules involved, some would say, are not really as interesting as the types of information flow that happens and the way in which the external universe is kind of implemented in some network of interactions here and all that. So, but in terms of actually doing something, you need to look at the external world and the internal world. So the external world provides a large number of stimuli to the cell, which cells have evolved to sense. These are usually extremely diverse types of signals, hundreds, you know, thousands of signals the cells can sense. Not to say that there are internal states that cells don't sense as well. But so these signals come in through protein networks that interact with each other, proteins that interact with each other, and basically carry out the transmission of this information. This information impinges on the way in which the information DNA is eventually turn into RNA, and then at that commitment step it could be translated into proteins, which fulfill a majority of the what biologists call the function of the gene eventually. And each of these steps in changing information from one form to the other can be influenced by proteins themselves, by RNA itself, and probably by DNA itself via its physical form. So all these arrows are supposed to impress upon you the sort of qualitative complexity that these networks can have. And there's a whole bunch of proteins that interact also with each other, and these can actually perform pretty interesting types of computations on their own. And also, of course, they influence the way in which all this information gets passed on. And of course, there's integration of signals even before you go and influence the way in which genes are expressed at the protein-protein interaction levels between signals. So, and these cells can come together and form networks of cells, and networks of cells can form organisms. Extremely simplified picture. It's probably offensive to most of you, as it should be. So what has emerged from decades of biology is a sort of a network epistemology these days, which is, which basically involves looking at all these different things. So the first part is actually knowing what your network is composed of, and this is what biologists have been doing for a very long time, and they've done a very good job of it. It's not comprehensive yet, but they're working hard at it, and it's asymptotic, and they'll get pretty good at it pretty soon. So we'll have a pretty complete parts list. What we know about these components is mostly about the regulation is mostly local. That means that individual laboratories have taken upon themselves to take a particular region of a gene that's involved in its regulation, and fiddle with it and figure out how that works. So that information exists for a large number of genes. But it's still far from comprehensive. So we have little caricatures of these local regulatory interactions that inform us on the types of regulation that happen genome-wide. But we know very little about the architectural features of how these local regulatory interactions fit into the whole cell and how the whole thing's working. We don't know much about this stuff at all. Of course, these are related to how these networks come about, which was, to some extent, the topic of the previous talk. We know that the networks obviously interact with the external world, but what signals they're listening to and how these signals are interacting with each other is far from understood. That's a significant gap in our knowledge. And when we talk about epistemology, what we're really interested is this is preaching to convert it in this room, because what we want to achieve is a predictive dynamical understanding of cells, is to be able to say this is what we know at this time and let's predict dynamics of the cell. That's where we want to go. We're far from that in most cases. So that was sort of the conceptual piece. This is some of the quantitative. So you can divide up the networks in the cell into many different subnetworks. Then we have the metabolic network, protein-protein interaction, and transcriptional regulatory subnetworks. And of course, these delineations are sort of artificial and sociological a lot of times. They're not really real. But basically, this network is involved in making precursors, making the basic stuff of the cell, and actually taking energy from the external sources and basically using it to do all the stuff that cells do. Protein-protein interactions, of course, mediate a lot of things, signaling, anything mechanical, structural, and so on. And transcriptional is sort of the fundamental, step of committing to expression of genetic information. And these are all coupled very strongly. So this ball of connections is inferred transcriptional regulatory interaction. So these red things are transcription factors, which are shortly described. And each of these lines from these red dots to these smaller dots around the periphery of the circle that you can't really see because they're too small is a transcriptional regulatory interaction inferred from what we know about that transcription factor's sequence affinity or spectrum of sequences that it binds via experimental data. So if you take a set of very well-characterized transcription factors in this organism, I don't have it, it's Saccharomyces cerevisiae, it's Baker's yeast, and build sort of a probabilistic description of weight matrix description, which you probably heard about from Eric Segal's talk yesterday, I hope. So if you do that, you can go throughout the genome and say, well, if you take the top 100 or 200 hits in the genome, where do these map? Which genes and so on. So, and basically, you draw. So this is not supposed. This is not real. This is what we infer from the. These are potential interactions that exist from knowing the weight matrix of these binding sites. So it's. It could be, and this is one thing to stress here is that this is probably about 10% of transcription factors and 10% of genes. So the real picture could be much more complicated. The red ones are transcription factors, and they can land on transcription factors, or they can land on just regular genes, right? This is just supposed to impress you with the connectivity. So the basic, each of these nodes can be sort of abstracted as this. So you have a region of the gene which is coding for the protein. You have a region where RNA polymerase, which is this large complex of proteins that actually recognize a small sequence here upstream of the gene and transcribe it into RNA. And then there are these shorter sequences, A, B, and C here, that are recognized by these transcription factor proteins. These transcription factor proteins, of course, are encoded by other genes in the genome, and they have the ability to sense various aspects of the environment, physicochemical characteristics of the environment, or the intercellular state of the cell. Or they could virtually be active by the virtue of being made, actually. So These things can bind to these sequences and they can interact with each other, interact with the polymerase, and basically change the expression of a gene. So you could have some sort of, you could abstract it as this, some sort of box where the occupancy of A, B, and C, the state of occupancies of these binding sites, it basically determines the output somehow, right? You could simplify it and say that it's binary output, but it's not in most cases. That actually level of the output really makes a difference. Of course, this is an overt simplification. In eukaryotic systems, DNA is packaged in nucleosomes and histones, and these are extremely important for the way in which genes are turned on and off. So these short DNA sequences that recognize transcription factors a lot of times do that, but the transcription factor itself doesn't do very much. It has to recruit other enzyme complexes that come and modify the histones. The histone tails usually are modified, and that changes the properties of the histones vis-a-vis interactions with other factors that come in and change the chromatin structure, or you can actually electrostatically change the interaction of nucleosomes with DNA, making it easier or harder for the gene to be transcribed into mRNA. Right. Is this, am I too jargony, or is this okay? So these things are all happening too. Oh, these things are modifications. So these are histone tails. I'll show you a little bit about this later, that are being modified, in this case being acetylated by this complex, and acetylation makes that region of DNA more accessible to, Well, that's a great question, and we'll talk a little bit about that later, hopefully as we get to it. But it can be 1,000 base pairs or more. And these things have an effect of actually, once you nucleate a site, you can actually extend in both directions and go off for a long ways. So in us, these effects could stretch for tens of kilobases, actually, in higher eukaryotes. In this yeast species, they're limited in range. To probably about a kb or so, what we think, but that's not a hard statement.
Does one have any idea which transcription factors interact with which ones do not?
They're being worked out. So there's a handful of them that are well characterized, and we know that they recruit particular histone acetylases or deacetylases. So, but for majority of transcription factors, this is not known. This is not to say that every transcription factor works by recruiting a chromatin modifier, but a large number of them we think do, and I'll show you an example of. So, this is our priors for what's going on. So we have about 4,000 genes in E. coli, 300 of them are transcription factors, the types of proteins I showed you, which you've heard about probably extensively in other talks. And this is a guessed by the virtue of the structural homology, because transcription factors are large class of, they're different classes of transcription factors, and their structures have been pretty well conserved, so we can go through the genome and annotate each gene as a possible transcription factor or not. Only about a third of these, third to a half of these are known or characterized in E. coli, and significantly fewer in other organisms. And this is what we guess as the number of inputs for each gene. So if you look at all these 4,000 genes, there are probably between 2 and 5 inputs from transcription factors into each gene. And this is a number we guess from our work, and I think in the human it would probably be even larger. So there's significant opportunity for combinatorial interactions of these inputs into basically encoding a complex gene regulatory expression pattern. So what can be observed? So whenever you're dealt with the system, you want to know what the observables are. So in this case, a lot of times the signals themselves are usually detectable, because actually these are the things that we can influence in the environment of the cell. So we can change the pH, temperature, and so on, and we know those things. In terms of what is happening in the inside of the cell with respect to the signals the cell cares about, we know very little of that. We can infer from some of these external signals that come into the cell what the states of particular transcription factors are, But by and large, we don't know very much about most of that, and we don't know what the state of metabolites are, which are actually influencing this as well. It's difficult to measure the state of a transcription factor's activity, whether it, so transcription factors become modified to be active or inactive by the virtue of adding phosphate groups to them, or actually some of them get cut up into two pieces. Some of them get translocated across the nuclear membrane. That's how they become activated. So there are all these different activation states that we can't really measure very well. Occupancy of site. So in a lot of cases, if we can monitor the occupancy of these binding sites, we know sort of what's happening. We know the transcription factor is either active or inactive in some cases. And that would be enormously helpful to us. But recent technology allows us to only look at, by and large, one of these sites at a time throughout the genome. So this is still kind of an immature field. What we want to do is be able to observe the occupancy of all these binding sites simultaneously across a set of conditions. The polymerase binding and activity, well, that's reflected in some sense in the transcriptional in the mRNA abundance of the gene. So this is something we can monitor pretty well now using a variety of different methods, mostly DNA chips, which I'll discuss shortly. So these are these chips. So there are two varieties. There is these spotted cDNA arrays, which is a very sort of a simple caveman technology. What you can do is to take a region of a gene, an entire gene usually of an organism, or cDNA, which is a region of the gene that's actually translated into protein, and take that and actually spot the entire DNA onto glass slide. This is about 100 microns in this spot. And then you can measure the mRNA that comes from that by hybridization of that mRNA. Because of complementarity, you can detect that hybridization when your probe is labeled fluorescently and so on. And you can compare two different mRNA pools that come from two different treatments. Or you can have these Affymetrix chips which take a gene and break it up into small pieces and put each of these sequences on a feature about 10 microns, a 10 micron feature diameter. So you can have about 250,000 of these features, each of which queries the abundance of the corresponding mRNA at different positions along the gene. So this is just technology. Take as much away as you would like. It's not really that important. So what do you want to understand? So as you all know, when we sequence an organism, we can figure out what genes it encodes by sequence homology. We can find open reading frames and look at other organisms in which we have we know the function of the homologous sequence and characterize its function. So it could be an enzymatic function like kinase or an acetylase, or it could be involved in a particular pathway such as glycolysis, lipid synthesis, or it could be actually involved in a sort of a higher order behavior like chemotaxis or cell death, right? So these are dimensions along which function is defined for genes. And there are probably many other ones that you would be interested in. For example, the subcellular location of a protein is important as a different dimension in functional characterization of a protein, right? But about the regulatory region, these regions are much more difficult to deal with, right? So this is the region that gives rise to the expression pattern of this gene, when and where and to what extent that gene is expressed, right? So we can, if you identify these binding sites for transcription factors, that gives us some information. That in itself, as I'll show you, is not enough. What we have to understand is something about the interaction of these sites or the transcription factors that actually bind them and program the logic. And then what we want to do is eventually to be able to predict the expression pattern of this gene, just as we can predict the function of a gene or sets of functions of a gene. What we want to do is from a regulatory region is to predict what the context of expression of that gene is across different conditions. So that I would say is a challenge to understand the regulatory regions in the genome. So one approach is to sort of do this kind of a blind reverse engineering approach, which is to say each gene can influence every other gene to some extent. And if you can make enough measurements of gene expression levels, you can put them into a black box and outcomes, some predictions about transcriptional regulatory interactions. And then once we have this model, we could integrate it and see what the if you can predict expression patterns. This is extremely difficult to do. We have thousands of genes, and the interactions that are happening between a lot of these genes are indirect, and they're happening with variables that we can't measure. But one thing that we do know is that these, as I've shown you, is that these interactions happen by protein-DNA interactions, where transcription factor proteins are binding to sequences, sequence specifically. So if you included that information, that may lead us somewhere. So one thing that we've been doing as soon as gene expression data was available was to exploit patterns. So what we knew from biology of organisms is that usually genes are regulated in large numbers. So when you need to adapt to a particular environment or turn on a particular process, you need a whole bunch of genes to be there doing that for you. So and a whole bunch means tens to hundreds of genes. So that would presumably give rise to an expression pattern of commonly regulated genes that we can exploit. The other is that that interactions between transcription factor and DNA sequences have been pretty well characterized, and you can actually have, people have developed very simple weight matrix models that basically take the interaction of each base pair independently, and that works pretty well in predicting actual binding sites. So there's a sequence pattern underlying the affinity of a transcription factor for its site. So these are the things we wanted to exploit. So in terms of patterns, this is a very simple thing. So in this cartoon, what we can do is, what we've done is to take genes 1 through n, and here is like 6,000 or 30,000 for the human, and just look at the expression of all these genes across different conditions. These could be different time points along the perturbations, or they could be different growth conditions. And in this case, you know, to represent it in three dimensions, I've only included three different time series, T1, T2, T3, three different time points. And in this cartoon, what you can see is each of these positioned is a gene, and basically its coordinates tell you how much that gene is expressed at different time points. But you can see there are clumps, there are regions of high density of genes. These are genes that have very similar expression patterns, right, across these three time points. And this is a very tight group here. This is not so tight. And this is very tight along the plane, but not along T1. So this is what we call patterns or clusters of genes. These are genes that are highly co-regulated across the conditions that we're looking at. And usually these conditions can be tens to hundreds to even a few thousand conditions. So there are various ways to, so this is just a cartoon. We want to identify these clusters computationally, and there's an enormous amount of work that's been done in this field outside of genomics. This is a very simple algorithm called the k-means algorithm. We basically randomly seed vectors in this space, and via multiple iterations, you converge onto the centers of these clusters by basically at every iteration taking the closest genes to your vector and calling them, you know, your vector, your cluster. And you do that, if the clusters are well separated from each other, you get this robust behavior where you identify clusters. And there are lots of embellishments on this, which is not really, I don't want to get into it, we can get into it after the talk. There's also, you've probably seen this hierarchical clustering, which is a different approach to grouping genes, basically, by their relationships. You can, by their similarities, you can group them together, put genes that are closely correlated on this axis, so on and so forth. So what the bottom line is that these expression clusters, or expression patterns of genes between 10 and 100, 200 genes, are presumably co-regulated because they share some aspect of the regulatory mechanism together. And the one that we've talked about is the fact that they probably are recruiting the same transcription factor into their upstream region, and therefore they probably have very similar binding sites for them. So this is what we exploited. So if you took those set of genes and if you look, they have, obviously they have to have a promoter where the RNA polymerase binds. but they actually have to have transcription factor binding sites as well. And in this very simplified model, we're just dealing with one transcription factor regulating the entire set. And we know that's not true, and we'll show you examples of that not being true. But, you know, they should have similar transcription factors, plural, if not transcription factor. So the very simple approach is to just take a set of genes in the cluster and look at the region that you suspect regulatory information lies. So in this case, we take sequences upstream of the translational start of the gene and go as far on this side as we can. We know that in yeast, in this organism, transcription factor binding sites basically lie in this region. And we feed them into an algorithm that looks for a motif or overrepresented subsequence, right? And outputs an alignment. So this is a pattern that's highly unlikely to happen by chance, and it happens in this set of upstream regions. We don't make it a requirement that this pattern happen in every gene that we're considering, but a significant number of them. And it's basically so this is a very sort of for those of you who've seen consensus sequences, this is a more informative way of doing that. So each position, it's a four-letter alphabet, so it can give you 2 bits worth of information. And so the height of these letters tell you how basically conserved they are in this alignment. And this is a binding site that we discovered. So once you have one of these, then you want to show that this is highly specific to the cluster from which it was found. And although other clusters may have it, there should be a predominance of this motif in the cluster from which it was identified. And that would be some way of linking that this sequence pattern to the expression pattern that you're looking at, right?
So in practice, how many fragments would you be aligning?
Oh, we usually don't like to look at expression clusters that are less than 10 genes because our ability to detect these signals falls. So between 10 and 300, for example. So this is a cartoon, but the set of genes that harbors this is about 200-300 in the genome.
And every sequence has to find someone from the motif, or you can give up on that?
No,
so there's
don't.
An overall average number.
Exactly. Yeah. In most cases, at best, only 70% of the members of a cluster have a strong match to the motif. Oh yeah, there's usually multiple hits.
And the line ace will take some estimate of false positives as a parameter. You have to tell the algorithm how many.
What it does, you say, well, give me as many motifs as are significant. And for any alignment that you have, typical alignment of, let's say, 100 upstream regions, it'll spit out 20 or 30 predictions. But it'll rank them. Right?
But it is trying to align everything. So
yeah.
If you
so it doesn't align it.
Drop some fraction dead, it could come up with a different alignment there.
Right. But if the pattern is.
The algorithm isn't doing that.
Is
the model that it tries to fit, though, specifically allows or can allow for non occurrence of motif in some of the examples.
No, is that what you meant by right? So that was Anirvan's question to some, which was, you know, we're just pulling all these input sequences and saying there is some predominant pattern. You could even ignore the fact that each of these chunks comes from an individual gene. Just concatenate the whole thing and say, find, you know.
Sorry, I mean, it could well happen that things are co-expressed, but there may be two dominant patterns, right?
Absolutely.
So you don't
allow
to just try to pick the best motif?
No. We find many motifs.
So you don't drop the ones that are...
No. We find lots of motifs, and then the job is to filter them out afterwards by some other criteria that we have.
But I guess the point I was making was you don't need to consider them. I'm saying there may be more than one that is valid, right? The same.
Absolutely. And there is in reality. Yeah. The input parameters are this, an expectation. So background basically distribution of bases. So what's the frequency of A, C, G, and T? What is the average, what is the expected length of a, or the width of a motif that you expect, right? And how many do you expect to have? How many binding sites do you expect to have in this set of genes, right? So that is a parameter that basically gives you some prior on, you know, and that determines your sensitivity and all these other aspects, right? Well, you need to have, in our hands, you need to have 5 decent sites in a set of 10 or so to find them. So if you have less than 5, then most of the time you won't find it. But if you have more than 5, so that seems to be, now that, and that, what do you mean by 5? You mean take a transcription factors, actual binding site, basically cut, make a threshold cutoff and take the sequences that we know are binding sites, place them in there, blah, 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 and see if you find them. And if they're less than 5, you know. In this case, where upstream regions are less than 1,000 base pairs, and the average is about 600 base pairs in length. But obviously, in higher eukaryotes, this is a much more difficult challenge. This is the general scenario. This is a lot of background that I'm presenting here. The basic idea is to gather a lot of expression data across diverse set of conditions, cluster that, find co-regulated genes, find motifs, and then once you find these motifs, rank them, because you find lots of them, by some other set of criteria which I'll describe, and then validate them experimentally. This is the factory of finding motifs. So this approach originally applied to the yeast cell cycle. So the yeast cell cycle is about 90 minutes. This is Baker's yeast. And what you can do is synchronize the entire population of cells in a flask such that they're all in the same phase of the cell cycle. Forget about how you would do that. It's very easy, actually. We can discuss that later. Once you do that, you take mRNA from those cells, from about 10 to the 10 to 9 cells, and you go through the preparations of labeling it and hybridizing to a chip, and you measure the expression level of all those genes. You have some matrix, and then you ask for a certain number of expression patterns. Out of that set, you say that you expect there to be 30 different expression patterns, and you apply different clustering algorithms. The first one we tried was k-means, which I talked about, and you get patterns like this. So this is one of the periodic patterns that we get, where genes are peaking at the G1S phase of the cell cycle. This is a pattern that we expected to find because we knew that there was already from the literature there are about 20 or so genes that had this behavior across the cell cycle. And when you look, one way to validate this expression pattern biologically is to say, well, if you took this set of genes, 186 genes that belong in this cluster, and you map them to known functional categories in databases that people have come up with, what do you see? So this class called DNA synthesis and replication has 82 members out of the 6,000 genes, right? What we found in this cluster of 186 are 23 occurrences of genes in this class. So 23 out of 186 in a setting where we have 82 out of 6,000 is extremely significant, and the p-value for that is 10 to minus 16. So this tells us something about the biological significance of the cluster. In this case, it's very trivial because we already knew sort of as soon as we saw the periodicity what types of genes we're looking for, right? But in general, this is more difficult and in a lot of cases more interesting because you find classes of genes that are co-regulated that you wouldn't have expected ahead of time. So, and then you look for motifs. This is one of the motifs this is the top motif that emerges from this cluster. One of the things is that it has a non-random distribution upstream of the start of the gene, telling us that there's something interesting about it. And also, when we look at the literature, this is the consensus for this site is what the literature calls the MCB box, which is known to be causally related to the regulation of genes in this fashion. So this is I want to go through this stuff really quickly because I want to get into a lot more interesting stuff. But we find different classes, so different periodic classes, genes that peak at G1S, genes that peak at M phase. In this case, we find 2 motifs. These are thought to have a redundant role in the periodic regulation of these genes peaking at G1S. We found this element called the ECB box upstream of this gene. These are the strongest motifs that emerge from these searches. So I'm not putting them up because they were matching the literature, but they were the strongest ones that emerged. So, and they happen to be the ones that the literature attributes to regulation. So these are validation, this is a new cluster, and these are two motifs that emerged from it that hadn't been characterized, that still remain uncharacterized because we haven't looked at them. But there are more interesting motifs that
what
we...
was the third one in which case?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is how... So if you take the top occurrence of this motif, you find... And these are the number of clusters, 1 through 30. You see that the motif... that the cluster from which the motif came from has the highest abundance of that motif. So that it's, just a, it's a measure of how specific that motif is from the cluster from which it was found, right? So if this was if this were flat, that would say, well, this is not interesting because it happens in a lot of other different patterns as well. So that's not interesting to us. But if it's highly, you know, specific to one cluster, then you can say, well, it's probably involved in the way in which that gene is expressed differently, and that's, that cluster is expressed differently.
So you had about 20-something
30. Clusters, 30. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a body that knows what's talking about for I mean, at least you obviously show us the periodic, but look at 30, most of them are the majority not periodic.
Yeah, it doesn't bother us at all. Well, we're looking at some combination of the two. So the method by which the cells were synchronized involves temperature shift. So there's that on top of it. So we think that's what's happening, is that a lot of the clusters that we're getting are stress response genes. And there are probably other interesting things that are going on too, because the cell density is increasing in the culture, right? So we see things that are going up like this, going down like this. So we find lots of different clusters. It's not just the cell cycle that we're finding.
Why do they look like damped oscillations? Of course, it's only two periods.
Okay, so, well, yeah, so they're dephasing is what we think, but that's, yeah, because you can't phase them perfectly. So we find things that, groups of genes that we knew already, or transcription factor binding sites that we knew already, and we found some interesting ones that we didn't know about, and I'll talk about two of these. This is a larger set of expression data spanning, you know, cell cycle, various perturbations, different carbon sources, and so on, that we concatenated. If you cluster this larger set across 99 conditions, you have, you know, here I've shown the average behavior of two of these clusters. And what's really interesting is that they're anti-correlated across almost the entire set. And if you look at the functions of these genes, you see that, you know, more than 90% of these guys are ribosomal genes. And this cluster contains most of the proteasomal genes. So the ribosomes make proteins and proteasomes destroy proteins. So there seems to be a transcription coupling between two processes that make proteins and destroy proteins in the cell. This wasn't known before expression data of this type was available. So if you look at elements, the top element that emerges from here is this sequence, which is a great match to RAP1, which has been known for many years to regulate ribosomal protein-coding genes. But we also found this motif element, one of the strongest motifs that we find, upstream of this set of genes. It was unknown. So one of the graduate students in George Church's lab actually took a genetic approach to identifying what that is. Basically, what you do is take this sequence and clone it into what's called a yeast-1 hybrid assay, which is basically a genetic approach to fish out the transcription factor that binds it. So if you think that this thing is real, we want to find something that binds it and regulates it. And that's what this one hybrid approach gives you. I can describe it to you afterwards in discussion, but I think we should go on to other things. But we found that, so Pete found that this thing is bound to sequence. It was formerly annotated at that point as a regulatory component of the proteasome itself. So this thing actually is part of the proteasome, but it happens to go back and forth and actually regulate the genes that make up the proteasome itself. So it seems to basically be involved in some sort of regulatory cycle. And the reason why it wasn't annotated as a transcription factor is that the zinc finger domain is too weak to be recognized. It fell below the threshold of automated zinc finger transcription factor detection motif. So there may be many transcription factors in the genome that we don't know, right? So the 200 or 300 predicted transcription factors may be an underestimate of the total number. So if you take a larger set of expression data and, you know, thousands, few thousands, and do this systematically, you find lots of elements. You find most of the known elements in the literature. You also find a lot of new ones that don't have a match to the literature. So what are these things doing? Some of them are involved in interesting peaks or, you know, valleys of expression in the genome. And this is a job of, to some extent, a job of biologists to follow through, but to some extent our job to do as much as we can to actually give them some identity, right? These all emerge from a lynase runs.
What's the longest
run? Oh, it's as long as you want it to. So we vary that expectation from 10 to 15. How much time do I have? Do I have to stop at 11:30? No, we started late, right?
We started late. You have another 15 minutes.
Oh, man. Okay, so I'll just skip that. Yeah.
Were the dashes there, were they ends, or were they really truly gaps?
These are, this means, and Chris's point is not real gaps. It means that there was no preference. There was a threshold cut when you generate these consensus versus the sequence logos that I showed you previously. So another approach, of course, is to use other species that exist. So if you compare the genomes of two organisms against each other, you'll see these coding regions sticking out very strongly, and you can map them to one another as orthologous genes, probably fulfilling similar functions in the two organisms. But we wanted to do the same thing for conserved regulatory elements, and this is work that Eric Sigio and others have done extremely well in prokaryotes, but we're interested in doing this in this organism systematically. So this is an example of a global alignment between two upstream regions of Saccharomyces cerevisiae and Saccharomyces bionus. And what you can see is conservation of this cassette region where there are two, what we think are binding sites lying in there. And we don't know why this region is conserved, but there may be something else found there. So you can, in a lot of these cases, you can actually align, do a global alignment and see region of conservation by just global alignment, but it's not systematic, right? So what we decided to do is to do this more systematically. The basic idea is to take the two organisms and basically find reciprocal best hits in the two so in between all the genes in the genome. So this is the best match of this gene in this organism and vice versa. These are orthologous mappings. You take the upstream regions of these genes, look for motifs, and somehow validate them. So what do we do?
How close are these?
They're 10, 15 million years divergent. Right. So we were at the mercy of what existed out there, right? So it turns out there's a European consortium, which I'll talk about, that sequenced partially 13 yeast species. And most of these species are too far from Saccharomyces cerevisiae to be useful, as I'll show. This one was the closest one, it seemed to be the most informative one. So what we did is to take a full genome of Saccharomyces cerevisiae and only about 10% of the genome of this phylogenetic neighbor, because that's all that was available to us. And so the results I'll show you is from that. So the basic idea is this, to take, so these organisms A and B, and I've cartooned here these regulatory elements here, different colors. If you take those pairs and look for motifs, you'll find them, you'll find lots of other things, which I'm not showing, but these have some probability of being identified in alignment between the two pairs. You do that for all of the orthologous pairs, and then you cluster them together by similarity. So if you expect this, some of these to be real, they should happen upstream of a lot of genes, not just one set of genes. You cluster them, then what you do is you try to strengthen the motif by taking genes from this cluster of motifs that gave rise to the motif. So taking these upstream regions that generated this black motif, Now put them all together and do a secondary motif.
I have a question in principle. If in the example you showed us one back where you do the global alignment, when you run this align A on such a pair that I understand you to be doing, you could put your motif anywhere in that 20-5 and 30 base block, so it would really go, and it would be equally significant anywhere in that region, I gather. So, what are you doing with that?
So this is an extremely cartoonish version of. So, you'll find all those sub. Right.
So basically, if they're able to get a window spaced by one base, just pile it across that 25 base chunk.
So, what Alinus does, what the particular implementation of Gibbs sampling does, it actually masks out. Once you find a motif, you mask out the middle of it so that, and then
but
you say.
It's completely arbitrary in that 25 base window where you drop your first motif. If not
right. But you'll find multiple motifs. So you look for, in this case, we expect 10 motifs. And you can vary that and see how your performance varies with respect to that.
You wouldn't say that some of the species were too far out. Transcription factor binding sites are not conserved.
Well, it's a combination of transcription factor binding sites not being conserved, the orthology mapping not being so good because the gene contents is significantly different, right? And the coverage being lower, sequence coverage from this. So it's a combination. But the first thing, which is the phylogenetic distance, contributes to two things. One is that maybe the transcription factors are missing. But because it's partial sequencing, the orthology mapping is not perfect. You have a lot of contamination. That's a problem, right? Sequence coverage is lousy, as I'll show you. And you're losing a lot of factors because you're a different organism.
Just as a control question, though, you're talking about a very close species of Saccharomyces, right?
So physiologically very similar. Right. You should. No. That's not what I'm saying. We haven't done this with Canada albicans. We're doing it with Pombi, which is, I think, further away. But yeah. But what we see at this point is much weaker conservation. There are some of these motifs that happen, you know, in all these organisms, but most of them are not. Somehow the transcription factor. So I'll talk about models if I have time of what's happening.
So with Candida, you can have right now complete.
Absolutely. We haven't tried Canada, but that's in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. I don't have any data to show you for Canada.
Yeah. You looked at Canada some years ago, and you will get, you know, if you do a pairwise match in upstream regions, you'll get a couple of hundred genes with a signal. Which I don't think says much of anything. I mean, well, with these weight making things, I could well imagine, like, even with, if you took Canada and then some of the closer ones, as was a good experience for bacteria, you could well pull out sites in Canada, even though at the pairwise level, you have a signal only for a very small fraction of genes. I mean, it would be much better. And then also in a couple of months, you will have.
So why did we do it with a partial sequence? Because, well, we started this, you know, about 2 years ago when that was the only data available. But we'll see how well this performs. So the idea here is to get as much information about the motif as possible by pulling together orthologous pairs that yielded a particular motif element. So these now. Larger coalescence of upstream regions has the opportunity to give us better definitions of motifs. So you do that search again, you find a motif, and here you have it. Now the key to this, so we generate thousands of motif predictions. The key to this is this the next step, which is similar physiology of these two organisms, even though we have very little sequence information, and it seems crazy to go about it at this point. Similar physiology means that you have similar genes and similar regulation. So what does that mean? Similar genes means that you have similar orthologous genes performing similar function. But similar regulation means that you have orthologous transcription factors, orthologous binding sites, and the most important thing about how our approach is successful given this lousy data is that if you have an orthologous process in the two organisms, they have to be regulated in the same manner. So you should find orthologous sets of co-regulated genes. That's key. So how do we do that? You take a motif prediction, you take the two organisms, you take the top occurrences of this motif in all the upstream regions of this yeast and the other yeast for the subset of the ones that you've mapped orthology for. And what you see in this cartoon example is that you have a significant overlap between the sets of genes that are regulated that have this element in one organism and in the other. And this is extremely unlikely to happen by chance, right? If this was some random alignment that was generated, right, it would be highly unlikely for it to have fallen upstream of largely the same set of genes. That's the key to this sort of network level conservation approach. So you find the overlap and you assess the significance of that. And this is just, yeah, you assess the significance of the overlap, right? It's non-random. So what we did was to take this Bionus, which was partially sequenced, for 715 upstream regions, we could get 200 base pairs or more sequenced to do this with. And what I want to do is not go through the details of this. So after assembly and doing the reciprocal base hit analysis, you end up with 715. That generates about 13,000 primary motifs. You cluster those into 3,000 motif clusters. And then you take these larger coalescence of upstream regions and you do motif search. And that gives you 80,000 secondary motifs. So now you have all these predictions of motifs, most of which are junk. They were just alignments that are being generated. We have to filter them out. So you apply this network level conservation, which says that if an element is fulfilling an orthologous role in the two organisms, it should happen upstream of the same set of genes in the two organisms. That is sort of the regulatory correlate of having a similar function, right? Not just being upstream of two genes, but upstream of the same set of genes that are being regulated. So we do that and we get 7,000 conserved motifs, and there's enormous redundancy here because you find the same motif many times. You cluster those and you get 1,300 tough motif predictions. What you do then is to just take those and match them against known weight matrices, right? And assign them. And we do extremely well, even though one may be pessimistic from the start using this approach. So what we have here is the name of the motif. This is the known weight matrix that we generated from a combination of binding data, expression data in the literature for these different transcription factor binding sites. And this is, out of the 1,300 motif predictions, these are the closest matches that we find. And you see in many cases, these are extremely close matches. So this one is the reverse complement. But what's really interesting is this value here, the p-value for having this network orthology characteristic. That means this motif falls upstream of the same set of genes in the two organisms to such an extent that that overlap would be only observed in 1 or 10 to the minus 28. Oh, the proteins that bind? For these two elements, we don't know. These are the most interesting elements in the genome, and we don't know what binds them. We're working on them. But it's partial sequence. For most of these transcription factors, we don't have the sequence between Bionus and... So like Eric says, the data should be available. It's been around for a while, but hasn't been published. The data should be available so that we can look at that. So that's a really interesting question.
Directly without sequencing, whether there is some part of the genome.
Oh yeah, so experimentally you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, you could do that, but I don't think anybody has done systematically for transcription factors. But we could say, so you can generate these sort of, you know, these sequences, sequence probes that are based on, but it's not great. I'd rather just go and sequence it. Yeah.
Can you try to combine it? Gone back to the expression data, even some of the original
clusters in the upstream regions, but then just looked at the highly homologous parts of those upstream regions. And then you rerun the motif. Would you find basically the same set of motifs, or would you have found new motifs?
That's a good question that we haven't done. But this method is identifying all those motifs that we found in the cell cycle. So what I really want to emphasize is these p-values here. Because you have these 1300 motif predictions that come about because of this filtering that happens. Right? So that's key to have this thing successful using correct information. So there are a lot of elements that we find where the genes that are being regulated by these putative factors are doing interesting things. They're interesting in terms of their coherence. So we find this element that, you know, basically is enriched in cytoskeleton and actin-associated proteins. A lot of other interesting things. This guy is involved in transport, ionic homeostasis. This guy is involved in nuclear pore complex, and so on and so forth. So we're finding lots of these out of our top predictions, lots of elements that are enriching for functional categories for which there is no information about regulatory mechanism. So that's interesting. And also, if you just take these regulatory elements and look at the expression data, significant number of them are actually giving you correlated genes. So that's another measure of their function, which we're exploiting. So now to go to Boris's question, if you go down, this is the ribosomal RNA phylogeny tree of these guys. So Bionis gives you, so we can, out of the set of 48 known transcription factors, we can find out at a stringent region, at being very stringent, 0.01, we can find about 70% of transcription factors this way. If you go down further to zygous Saccharomyces rouxi, which I think is about 15 million years or so, you find many less. And the sequence coverage actually between these two guys is not so different, right? So we can all talk about why that's happening. It turns out Clovermyces lactis, which is actually further away from both of these, from rouxi, does it a little bit better at this higher level of stringency than does rouxi. So there's a lot of interesting things that are going on here. What do I have? I had a whole slide of the transcription factors that were highly conserved. So the two elements that I showed you where we don't know what binds here, which is the subject of the rest of the talk actually, these two elements occur upstream of most of these organisms. The rest of them are not so highly conserved, the rest of this transcription factor binding site. So we think these things are ancient. The genes that are harboring these elements are by and large doing ribosomal RNA transcription and processing duties. For some reason, that component of the ribosome is being regulated in a completely different way. So how much time do I have? 5 minutes, okay. So there are different models of how we think about these guys evolving. So you could imagine that these organisms kind of geographically isolate and they become kind of specialized in different ecological niches, and they lose the requirement for a particular transcription factor. For example, in one case, maybe the transcription factor is regulating a set of genes that involves taking in zinc. But if they happen to be in a zinc deficient environment all the time, they don't need a transcription factor. Those genes will always be on. You can lose a transcription factor because it's not serving you any function. Or the other way around, where you could be in a zinc-rich environment, in which case you could also lose it, right? So there are lots of ways to think about the physiological divergence and the requirement for keeping transcription factors. So that's very simple thing, is you lose a transcription factor and you don't need it. And that actually is what geographically isolates you. And then the binding sites erode away and you won't find them. The other thing is, you know, you could develop a, you know, mutation in the binding domain of transcription factor, and then over time sequences drift to get there, or maybe not. Maybe this mutation is subtle, that most of the targets are actually still being regulated, right? and the fulfilling the function, but we're not identifying it using our approach because they've drifted far enough away. So there are lots of other models, interesting models that one can entertain that involve, you know, physiology and so on. There's a whole genome duplication that happened before these guys were diverged, after these guys were diverged. And so you could imagine that there are a lot of orthologous transcription factors that have sort of come about that didn't exist in one species versus the other. But one of the things that we're doing is, once we have this list, so this was mostly done because we wanted to validate our expression data-derived motifs, and it does an extremely good job of doing that. But we have all these predictions, now we're going after motif interactions. So the two elements that I told you were the most strongly conserved evolutionarily-wise co-occur upstream of a significant number of genes together, and that's really interesting to us. So if you take these two elements, PAC and RPE, which are involved in these processes, what you'll see is a lot of deviation from randomness. So these two elements co-occur upstream of a significant number of genes in the genome. That gives sort of a hint. Their position upstream of the start of the gene is extremely biased towards about 100 base pairs. There is a relative distance constraint, and also there's a bias to the orientation of them. So all these non-random characteristics of these motifs are kind of telling us that these things may be interacting, right? So a very simple thing. If you take all the genes in the genome that just have one of them or the other, and you look at the distribution of correlation coefficients of the entire set, right? So that goes from minus 1 to 1. The green is all the genome, so it's centered roughly about 0. If you take one, all that have this on PAC only, you have this red distribution, which is extremely significantly shifted to the right. The same thing is with blue. Now, if you think that there's an interaction between them, then the combined should be highly unlikely from the individual distributions, and it is. So we get much larger shift to the right. So that's telling us that these things are interacting with each other. Another aspect of the interaction is this. Now that we have two motifs, we can entertain order. And if you take the two different orders that exist here, if you take this guy, the red one, you see that there's some shift to the right, still significant. But then if you take the other order, we see even a stronger bias towards being co-regulated. So that's telling us that order matters here. We've done subsequent analysis, and actually order here is serving as a proxy for the position of PAC. Turns out what is really constraining this gene expression pattern is the fact that PAC has to be close to the gene, not that the orders. Because if you look at this set, you'll find weaker PAC here and weaker RP in some of them. So we're doing this systematically and finding these interactions, incorporating them in Bayesian models. And the idea is to soon be able to predict from the sequence what expression pattern you belong to. That's the idea. Can we capture enough information about these regulatory elements and their interactions to be able to predict the gene expression of that gene under a set of standard conditions? Once we get there, then we're happy. So one thing that's really interesting so there's a whole bunch of experimental stuff that I haven't had a chance to go into, but we can talk about it at the discussion. But one thing that's really interesting is this phenomenon that we observe. Is if you take this, our top 700 predictions of motifs, map them throughout the genomes, and look at the number of inputs per gene, this is a distribution that you get for non-transcription factors. So these are just regular, boring genes. And it's sort of centered around 30 or so, but it falls off with this tail here. Now this seems unreasonable as a number of inputs, right? It's because there's a lot of redundancy in this set of predictions still. But what we see at all levels of out of any set of motifs that we think are real is a significantly higher connectivity for the subset of the genome that wires transcription factors to transcription factors. So it seems like transcription factors have more inputs into them. So what's emerging is this idea that there's this transcription factor interaction network that basically is doing some sort of interesting computation, deciding sort of what to turn on. And then there are these sort of foot soldier genes that carry out those duties. So this is our kind of hand-waving argument for what's happening. Yeah. So this is probably not reflecting the actual bindings, actual individual transcription factors, because of the redundancy in the set of factors that we have and the depth at which we're considering this. So in this case, we're going 300 deep. That means find the top 300 binding sites in the genome. So for a lot of transcription factors, those are not functional binding sites.
And these are just known factors, as predicted factors?
This is the entire set of 700 that come out of our analysis that are functionally enriched, expression enriched, and known. But if you take the known subset, you'll see a similar thing. If you just take the 48 known transcription factors, you see exactly the same thing.
And is this merely a correlation between transcription factors and large upstream, long upstream?
It's not. Well, there is an upstream region factor. Transcription factors have longer upstream regions. But even if you include that, if you control for that, you still get a significant shift to the right. So what we're thinking is happening, the majority of this effect has to do with the longer upstream region. And we think what's happening is that you just need to pack more of them in there, and that's somehow interesting, right? Is that transcription factors are doing more of the more of the thinking, I guess.
Okay, we have to move on from
right.
If you know the upstream region for transcription factor is somehow greater, and say you know worst case scenario, many of these are called off. Uh-huh. Just randomly hit more in this longer upstream region for transcription factor. Forgive me for suggesting the worst case scenario, but could that approximate the situation?
Right. So we know that there is an effect even when you control for the length, but length upstream region. But the fact that transcription factors have a significantly longer upstream region is still in itself interesting. What we're saying is that you need to accommodate for more transcription factors. That's why you have longer upstream regions. That's in essence what we're saying.
Okay, sorry, we have to move to the next talk. I'm sorry. We can have a discussion and we'll take the increase and we can have this discussion. The next talk will be